This is episode 96 of Social Entrepreneur with Lee Wallace of Peace Coffee.
We come to this work with the idea in the sense that what we're doing is working on trying to elevate the livelihood of an awful lot of people who have historically been very disadvantaged when it comes to the way trade works.
Welcome to the Social Entrepreneur Podcast. My name is Tony Lloyd. I'm a former business executive with Fortune 500 companies. Today, I spend my time with changemakers who are making an impact in the world. Each week, we bring you exciting stories from the world of social entrepreneurs, benefit corporations, and impact investing. Thanks for being with me today. Let's get started. Hi, and welcome to episode 96 of Social Entrepreneur with Lee Wallace of Peace Coffee. Before we jump into today's episode, I have a little announcement to make. We have an upcoming webinar. This is going to happen on July the 20th. That's a Wednesday at noon U.S. Central Time. And I'm hosting this webinar. It's called How to Make a Difference While Making a Living. Hint, no ramen noodles are required. So in this webinar, we're going to talk about how to go from being a compassionate person to being a change maker, how to overcome the five most common roadblocks to being a change maker, the seven key characteristics of successful change makers, and the 10 steps on the path to change making. That's a lot of numbers, isn't it? Well, no math is required. So if you want to know more about that, just go over to tonylloyd.com/difference. TonyLloyd.com, TonyLloyd.com/difference, and you can register for that webinar. Again, it's on July 20th at noon Central U.S. time, and it's called How to Make a Difference While Making a Living. Hint, no ramen noodles are required. So let's get into our show. Now, imagine, if you will, that you're working in a nonprofit in the middle of Minnesota, and you're focusing on public policy. And the phone rings, and the person on the other end says, "Hello, this is the Port of Los Angeles. We have 38,000 pounds of green coffee with your name on it. What should we do with it?" Now, that's exactly what happened at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. And Lee Wallace is going to tell you the story of what happened with that coffee and the next shipment of coffee and how Peace Coffee was born. And by the way, they make a wicked cup of coffee. It's really good stuff. They are a for-profit social enterprise, and they're owned by this nonprofit, the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. Last year, Peace Coffee purchased 735,000 pounds of coffee from 12 countries and from 20 smallholder farmer cooperatives, and in the process, they paid fair trade premiums in excess of $370,000. It's a great story. I think you're going to enjoy it. Here she is, Lee Wallace of Peace Coffee.
My name is Lee Wallace, and I am the Queen Bean, or CEO, of Peace Coffee.
So what does a Queen Bean do?
A Queen Bean is like a CEO, but with a little bit more personality and a little bit more relaxed, I guess, is my hope.
Yeah, exactly. That's good. So Peace Coffee, just describe for people who don't know Peace Coffee, what is it?
Yeah. Peace Coffee is a social enterprise. We are a for-profit corporation. We're owned by a nonprofit organization, and I can talk a little bit more about that in the future. But we were founded 20 years ago, and we were founded out of conversations with coffee farmers. So the nonprofit organization that owns us is called the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. And they are an organization that focuses on policies that benefit farmers in rural communities. So in the lead up to NAFTA, they were having conversations with coffee farmers and beginning to think about how to extend their lens more globally and think about policies to benefit small scale farmers in countries around the world. So in the lead up to NAFTA, they're talking to these coffee farmers and they say, "How can we make our policy work more relevant to you?" And the coffee farmers say, "You know what? Policy work doesn't help us feed our family. Policy work doesn't help us send our kids to school. We don't need policy work. What we need is someone to provide us with better markets." The folks at IATP said, "That's great. We're not business people. We're policy people. Can we return to our question?" Well, this conversation went back and forth for a while. And eventually, the folks at IATP said, you know what, we really will consider your request to buy your coffee, but we're going back to Minnesota now. Well, a few months later, the Port of Los Angeles called, and they said to whoever answered the phone at IATP, I don't know who that person was, but they said, hey, this is the Port of Los Angeles calling. We have about 38,000 pounds of green coffee for Mexico with your name on it. How would you like to get that coffee to Minnesota? So unlike a lot of companies, we were born out of this conversation about how to do the right things for farmers. And that's what I would say that Peace Coffee does. We think hard about how to do the right thing for coffee farmers.
Yeah.
So we have a wholesale business that we've been operating for 2 decades. And we've been branching out into retail. So we've been in retail for 5 years. And we have 4 branded retail coffee shops that we own and operate that are all in the Twin Cities.
Okay. So when you... Do you know the answer to the question, what did they do with the 38,000 pounds of coffee
in
the Port of Los Angeles?
Sure, sure.
What happened?
Sure. I mean, you know, this is what they did. When I was a kid, I drove an ice cream truck. And I always think about this as the same kind of story when I first got, you know, 16 years old, got my driver's license, and rented an ice cream truck for the summer. So what they did was they came up with the money. It's business 101. They came up with the money that they needed to buy that first 38,000 pounds of coffee. And they went to their friends. They said, hey, we have this coffee. We're going to try to sell it because we're all about farmers. So they got their friends to dip into their pockets, and they came up with the money they needed to buy that inventory. And then they went out and they found someone to roast it. And then they priced the coffee so that they could make their money back. And, I mean, some of my neighbors still tell stories about some of those staff members walking around literally door to door and saying, hey, we got this coffee and we're looking, you know, we're trying to find people to buy it. So they sold that first 38,000 pounds of coffee and then, you know, divided the money into 2 piles, money to pay back to our investors and money that we have left over. And wow, hey, we made a profit. Maybe we should keep doing this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's amazing. Did they have a brand name at that time? Did they say Peace Coffee or how?
No. So that first container came from Mexico.
Yeah.
And they're nonprofit folks, so they didn't have a lot of experience thinking about what you name a company. So they named the company Headwaters International.
Okay.
Which sounds like someone who makes, you know, widgets and, you know, gaskets or something. I don't know what Headwaters International would do. So our second coffee that we purchased was from Guatemala. Mm. And that was just after the Guatemala Peace Accords had been signed. And so we named the Mexican coffee as like a product was called Aztec Harvest. And then the Guatemalan coffee as a product was called Guatemalan Peace Coffee. Mm. Well, what happened was our customers named us. So people started calling us that Peace Coffee. Mm. And that is how we got our name.
Wow, that's a good story. Where did you come in? How did you join either your parent organization, the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, or Peace Coffee?
I started at Peace Coffee 10 years ago.
Okay.
So I've been here for half of the company's existence.
Okay.
I originally actually came in as a consultant.
Mm.
So I had been working on my own out of my home and was really trying to figure out how to find a career that made sense to me in terms of my passions.
Right.
Or a job that made sense to me in terms of my passions.
Right.
And I basically come to the conclusion that I wasn't going to find that working for somebody else, that I was going to have to create that for myself. I'd been working from home for a while, and what I was trying to do was find places that sit at the nexus of mission and money, because that's what I'm really interested in.
Mm.
So how do you generate money for a mission? And so I was doing consulting work. I was doing strategic planning work, business development work, board development work, whatever I could find that really helped me help organizations think about where these two things meet. Well, I'd been networking, as one does when they're trying to drum up business.
Sure.
And had happened to go out with a board member from Peace Coffee and explain to them who I was and what I was thinking about. And I was open to thinking about providing interim leadership to organizations. And I'm pretty agnostic about organization form. I don't care if it's a for-profit. I don't care if it's a nonprofit.
Right.
What I'm really interested in is, you know, how you use business thinking to generate profit that supports a mission. So I originally came in, they needed someone to come in and do an assessment because they were 10 years into owning this company and scratching their heads and saying, you know, why do we own this company? How does it support our mission, you know, what should we do with this company that is, you know, getting pretty big now. And so they hired me to come in and do the assessment, and pretty quickly I realized this place is a pretty magical place for me. And it's where a lot of things come together in terms of my background and my experiences and what I care about and what I think I can make an impact on. So I like to joke that they just haven't noticed that I haven't left yet. but they did actually eventually just hire me to run the company.
Okay. Yeah. Good. So your degree was in like public policy.
I have a undergraduate degree in anthropology. Okay. And I have a master's degree in public policy.
Okay. How did you learn to be a CEO?
Well, so, that's a really good question. And I appreciate you believing that I know how to be a CEO.
We're still here.
I have always been interested in how organizations work. I mean, I think that's one, I would put that alongside everything else as one of my primary interests. Mm-hmm. And I've always been interested in the role that corporations and organizations have in people's everyday lives. I mean, we spend a lot of our time at work. And a lot of what I studied in anthropology is how people organize themselves. I mean, that was a lot of my interest and why I was drawn to the field of anthropology. The reason why I got a public policy degree was it was the 90s, and I went to the Carlson School and said, hey, I have this background in natural foods, I have this background in nonprofit organizations, and I've done all of these different things. I'm really interested in going back to school and thinking about this. And they said, oh, no. If you want to think about mission, you're a policy student. You're not a business student. So I ended up getting my master's in public policy by default and then kind of leveraged that into my immediate job after I left policy school. Was that I had a fellowship at the Blandin Foundation where I helped them think about the role that business incubators can play in revitalizing rural communities. So wow. I've always kind of played along this edge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you said you have a background in natural foods.
Yeah.
So where does that come from? What's that?
So when I was 20, I started working in a food co-op. And I worked in a food co-op through college graduation, and just got a lot of experience in just understanding that shopper, understanding that consumer. The Twin Cities is an amazing place to learn about natural foods because we have such a vibrant and thriving co-op ecosystem.
Yes.
And, the co-ops at that time were really thinking about how to compete and how to compete about conventional retailers and really maturing very rapidly. So it was a great time to be in that space and see that work happen.
Yeah.
And then I went from there to be in on the governance side and run for the board of a food co-op and be on that side for a while.
Wow, that is great experience leading up to what you're doing today.
Yeah, this was a really interesting convergence of a variety of things. So I grew up in upstate New York and moved here when I was 18 to go to college. But my dad had gone through seeing economies really shrink in many communities in upstate New York and, you know, on the western side of the state, the steel industry dying up, and on the eastern side of the state, a lot of things that went up and down the Hudson River drying up and people leaving farms. And he was really interested in us understanding these stories when we were kids, all the way back to the town that I grew up in was where gas lights were made for New York City. It's where men's detachable collars were sewn for New York City. So just north of New York City on the Hudson River. And my dad really wanted us to understand the history of industry as it came in and out of communities and how that really impacted families in those communities. And he would take us on weekends. We went and we would tour. We toured the last wooden dowel manufacturing company in the United States one time and all walked out of there. I'm like 8 years old and I have a cutting board, you know, that's made, you know, one of the last cutting boards made in the United States. And he had this real passion for getting us to understand really that employment is vital to the health of a community. And so I kind of, you know, moved forward with that into my career. And then I had this interest in natural foods and a lot of relationships in natural foods. And then also my grandfather was a Latin American affairs person for the State Department, and he worked on the meetings side of things. So he would plan meetings if the U.S. had a strategic interest in having a meeting with someone in Latin America about something. And he and my grandmother traveled extensively throughout Latin America, and that was always a huge part of our understanding. My mom was born in Mexico and lived there, and so when I discovered kind of, both the way I was raised and then my own personal passions, and they all kind of came together here, and I'm not leaving.
I love it. I could probe into that forever.
Yeah.
Just one quick question about that. Why do you think your father wanted you to understand all that? Where did his drive for that come from?
He watched... grandparents came to the United States and settled on the New York side of Lake Champlain and established a bunch of businesses. And I think he understood from a very early age that their health as a family really depended on whether or not people could afford to buy insurance,
right,
or whether or not people could afford to go to the dentist, or whether or not people could afford, to hire whatever their family businesses were. And so I think he grew up kind of steeped in that sense, that the over-economic health of the community, because his ancestors had these small businesses,
right,
really would impact your viability as a family unit.
Right, right. I love it. So economic development within a community,
yep,
very vital,
yep,
important jobs, all that. Get it. Totally get it. So when it comes to Peace Coffee, the parent organization, they were in Latin America. They were saying, policy-wise, what can we do for you? And they were saying, buy our coffee at a good price. So it's basically fair trade.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what happened then? They had that shipment. They sold it. They bought another shipment.
Right.
And they suddenly found themselves in the coffee business. Okay.
Yeah.
Say more about that.
Well, if you look at the early, like so many other businesses, you think you know what you're going to do when you start.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you actually end up doing, if you're actually learning from the experience that you're having, ends up, generally diverging. And, you end up following this really interesting path.
Yeah.
So originally, they conceived of this company as a way... to continue to build the idea of buying things at fair prices from producers in Central and South America. So the original idea was not that we'd be a consumer brand. It was that we would be an importer of all kinds of things. So we purchased fair trade soccer balls for a while. There was an idea that maybe we'd purchase crafts and hacky sacks and things like that.
Right.
But what really ended up happening was we emerged as this consumer-facing brand that was really focused on how do we buy more coffee at fair prices from small-scale coffee farmers and how do we bring that to market.
Right.
And that's what we've been focused on. The big moment in time, I would say, was in 2002. So from 1996 to 2001, we were incubated in the basement of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. And in late 2001, the company made the decision to move into its own headquarters and to begin to roast our own coffee. If we had stayed using a contract roaster and kind of being this middleman pass-through organization, I don't think we would have gotten to where we've gotten to today. We really needed to take more and more of the value chain under our own roof, get very serious about it in order to compete and really focus on the quality of our product.
Right, right. Give people a sense of the scale of Peace Coffee today.
Yeah, so we have about 60 employees.
Okay.
And last year we purchased 735 pounds of fairly traded and organic coffee from...
How many?
735,000 pounds.
Thousand. I didn't hear the thousand part. I heard 735 pounds. I'm like, wait, what?
yeah.
Okay, so 735,000 pounds.
Yep,
okay.
From 12 different countries and 20 small farmer cooperatives.
Okay. And so the relationship from the beginning has been with cooperatives? Is that the way they...
Yeah, that's a key part of what we do. So more than 50% of the world's coffee farmers farm coffee on very small parcels of land, so less than 12 acres of land, okay? And one coffee plant will yield 1 pound of roasted coffee per year. Coffee also is not a crop that wants to be monocropped. It's typically mixed in, amongst other fruit trees and things like that. So it's not as if these farms are all just dedicated to coffee. So we have very small farmers growing more than half of the world's coffee. And so we come to this work with the idea in the sense that what we're doing is working on trying to elevate the livelihood of an awful lot of people who have historically been very disadvantaged when it comes to the way trade works. Mm-hmm. And so that's the focus on fair trade and co-ops for us. So farmers come together when they don't have enough coffee on their own to market to, directly to any coffee buyer. They'll come together in co-ops and pool their coffee and then work to sell that coffee directly to coffee buyers.
Do you feel like the problem you're trying to solve is livelihoods for small crop farmers in a way, or for coffee farmers per se?
I think that there's a lot more around it than that, and that's what's really interesting about this work. So key thing about co-ops is that in many, many different communities, coffee is grown at high elevation and in pretty rural, isolated areas that are lacking basic infrastructure in many cases, right? So Peru is a really good example. More than 50% of Peru's population lives in Lima. And there's no incentive for people to move out of Lima and back into the countryside. So we work with a group called Pengoa. It's a co-op. It's based in eastern Peru in the Amazon basin. It is a very, very long bus ride to get there. And then once you get there, you're in total paradise. Mm-hmm. But there's no infrastructure there at all. Or there is now, but there wouldn't be without the co-op. I mean, the co-op has built a hydroelectric power plant for the community. The co-op builds and maintains the roads. The co-op has built and maintained centralized composting stations for all the farmers to get really high quality inputs. The co-op's focusing on income diversification, things like that. So it's livelihoods, but it's also overall community development. And it's supporting areas where there's no civil society, and these co-ops are stepping in and playing the role of civil society in these communities. And what I absolutely love about it is that our lens, go back to my childhood, our lens is that people in these communities have ideas and know how they're going to make their communities better. And our job is to be a good partner on the other side of that and help them take those next steps toward how they're going to improve their community. And now that we've been doing this for 20 years, we're able to, really say we've seen this. We've seen success at this type of partnership.
Right. Now, before you and I started recording here, you talked a little bit about vertical integration.
Yeah.
So help me understand, where do you play in the value chain?
Right. So from 1996 to 1999, we were just kind of beginning to explore this business. I said we bought coffee from Mexico, we bought coffee from Guatemala, and then pretty quickly we realized, wow, that's some really chunky growth. If you're thinking about your growth in 40,000 pound increments and you're a very, very small company. So what a lot of coffee companies do is they work with an importer. Now, I say this at risk of offending some of my coffee colleagues, but I'm going to say it anyway. Everybody likes to act like that importer doesn't exist between them and the coffee farmer, and that they, just fly right to the coffee farmer's fields and they throw, 250-pound bags on their back and walk away. Well, guess what? There's a lot of customs work involved with getting coffee into anywhere, really. So in 1999, we came together with seven other companies and formed our own importing company. That importing company is structured as a co-op. There's now 21 of us that own this importing company, and it is a pre-competitive collaboration. So we are all fair trade organic coffee companies. We are located across North America. So our northernmost member is in the Yukon Territories. Our southernmost member is in Florida. So we span all of North America. And this is a vehicle for us as a group to make sure that we are buying coffee in the most conscious, mission-based way possible, but also that we're really active and engaged and own the relationships with the places that we buy coffee from, that we're involved and understand firsthand the challenges that coffee farmers are facing and understand ways that we might contribute to overcoming those challenges. And as anybody who has thought about business before knows, you know, you can... businesses can play different roles, and we can run this importing business in such a way that we're really focused on getting as many dollars as possible into the value chain, which is a really cool opportunity.
Yeah. When do you negotiate price with a co-ops? Is it like pre-season growing, or is it after harvest, or when does all that stuff happen?
So we cannot get away from the commodities market, right? The commodities market still drives a lot of what is happening in terms of how coffee's priced. Mm-hmm. We work to get further and further away from that as possible. And I would say the world that we work in, this high-end specialty coffee world, is divorcing itself more and more. So as the New York commodity price of coffee fluctuates, we're seeing our prices don't chase it down as much. So that's really good. What we do is we have a price floor. So we say, you know, we believe that below this level, it's unsustainable for coffee farmers to buy coffee. But then the co-ops need to compete. They need to get individual farmers to bring their coffee in. So if it's a year where the New York commodity price on coffee is very high, we will, you know, go up to that price because we really need to support the viability of these co-ops and keep them healthy through high prices.
Right. How do you make up for that, though, if and maybe I'm getting this wrong, but if you have a floor below which you won't go.
Right.
Right. And but then in, let's say, maybe lean production years, commodity prices go up.
Sure.
And now you have to go up.
Yep.
So you're paying here.
Right.
And then everybody else is going to make up for some of those monies by going below that floor where you're at. Yeah. So how do you do that? How do you manage for that?
We're a low margin business.
Yes.
You know, we are working the phones all the time. Yeah. Nobody brings our coffee in through the door without understanding our business. Mm-hmm. And I mean that in all seriousness. You know, we are in Target stores. We are in, you know, lots of grocery store chains. We are in food co-ops. All of those people understand the nature of our business. And so if the price starts going up, we call people and we say, hey, we're in the business of helping farmers. You know, there's two things. Number one, we're in the business of helping farmers. So the more coffee we can sell, the better we can do for coffee farmers. All of the co-ops that we work with will report that they have supply that they would like to sell us. They have more coffee. If we can find more ways to sell their coffee, they have more coffee to give us. But the other thing is, why would I ever take business that's going to actually hamper our ability to do the right thing by coffee farmers? So that's a very, very serious conversation that we have with any account before they bring us in through the door. And they need to know, you know what? I'm going to call you if coffee price starts going up.
Right.
And then our price may well need to go up on your shelf. But we've been doing this for 20 years now. And, you know, together we can message this to consumers. So we've been successful at it so far.
Right. And if your prices are going up, the other producers are going up as well.
Well, that's the thing. The reality is that Starbucks is never going to make as many phone calls as we make. But, you know, I can tell you what I've learned over the years. I've learned over the years that people, you know, face the same pressures we do in terms of maintaining margin.
Sure.
And something like a publicly traded corporation is going to actually face a lot more pressures than we do. So their prices will go up as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you think about the impact that you've been able to have as a company, how do you think about that? Is there a way that, you know, you gave me some great numbers. You said you're buying 735,000 pounds of coffee from 12 countries, from 20 co-ops.
Yeah.
Those are good numbers. When you think about then the impact.
Right, right.
Any further thought about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things that I would say. You know, one thing has been it's been amazing to watch communities go. So the old fair trade was people need health clinics, people need schools, people need roads, people need clean water. Mm-hmm. That was the business that we were in the early years. And it's been tremendous to see that infrastructure get built, mm-hmm. and then what we've seen come after that. Mm-hmm. So I was in Guatemala last June, and this is a good example. So, you know, the first time I was going to Guatemala, it was like, hey, look, we got electricity. You know, hey, look, we got a well. Mm-hmm. And now it's, we are running these demonstration farms, and we are innovating around organic practices, and we are working with researchers in other countries, and we are playing leadership in terms of information flow, again, across growing organizations all over Central and South America. And so we can just track that development over the years. And as I said before, we're really interested in this idea that, you know, we're partnering with people who are focusing on making their community better, much like we're trying to make our community better here in the Upper Midwest. It's just really neat to watch those things start to come into fruition and the basic building blocks, so that people aren't worried about their kids getting sick or not having pencils, you know. And then you get beyond that, and they're actually doing business development work, right. And they're actually focusing on training the next generation of farmers and making sure people have jobs, and, you know, making sure that there's scholarship funds and there's banks being built and there's insurance agencies being developed by the co-ops. A really, you know, amazing example would be the Democratic Republic of Congo. So was in war for years, war-torn nation, and farmers were still growing coffee, but there was no opportunity to export it. So they were putting their coffee on boats, and they were sailing across Lake Kivu, and people were perishing trying to get their coffee, you know, across the lake and to a place where they could sell their coffee. So a few years ago, a little bit of a nascent coffee economy began to emerge. I believe it was 2 years ago we bought our first coffee from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and when we asked what the coffee, what the fair trade premiums were going to be used for, so I should back up and talk a little bit about the fair trade premium. So,
yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. So when we say, when you talk about impact, there is, we pay basically a community development fee is what I would call it. So there's a premium associated with buying fair trade coffee is a 20-cent economic development premium, basically. 5 cents of that needs to go into improvement of quality. And then the remaining 15 cents, the co-op votes on what that goes to. So what I would say is, you know, another stat is that we paid, last year in 2015, we paid $370,000 in fair trade premiums to communities. So fast forward to the Democratic Republic of Congo, when after our first year of buying coffee from them, when we asked them, you know, what are you going to spend this money on? The answer was, we don't have roofs on our houses. So we're going to spend this money to buy pieces of sheet metal to put on the top of our houses.
Yeah.
Well, our director of coffee just got back a few years later, and they have moved from we don't have roofs on our houses to we're coordinating a national initiative to train people in how to taste coffee so that we can improve the quality of our product.
Wow.
I mean, that's just really exciting for us to see. We're able to put resources into just supporting business development work, supporting them in getting better at being coffee growers, being better at selling coffee, understanding, you know, how to sample roast coffee, how to taste coffee, and that we're able to support that work.
Mm. That's good stuff. So You're in kind of a complex organization in
yeah.
many ways, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
not only do you have this nonprofit that owns all the shares,
yep.
you have this company you have to run, just like a traditional company with shareholders,
right.
and you have this complex value chain
right.
that you're fully integrated throughout.
Right.
So if you think about maybe the low point,
right.
where yeah. is that?
So in 2012, we saw prices for coffee just go through the roof.
Yeah.
And our margin evaporated.
Yeah.
And I think the hardest part of what we're doing is that because we're owned by a nonprofit, we're pretty chronically undercapitalized.
Yeah.
And so we've had to really figure out, and I think social enterprises just face this issue, we just don't have as much upside. So we can't get a lot of investors to just be like, yay, I'd love to give you money, because you basically don't make a ton of money.
Right.
And so whereas we those of us who work here and our ownership and other folks are really excited and passionate about what we do. There are times, and there have been times, where it's just been incredibly stressful.
Sure.
Because, you know, you're not exactly clear on where your money's going to come from moving forward. So we faced some very serious financial pressures for a couple of years in there.
Right.
And I would say that that's probably the most stressed out. Nobody likes worrying about money. And then when you employ a lot of people, you really don't want to worry about what actions you're going to have to take.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. You know, these as organizations, I think of these organizations as big-hearted, kind people.
Yeah.
Right? And the last thing you want to do is have a hard conversation with somebody about cash flow and about what's happening with all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I totally get that. What do you think you learned out of that? What came out of that for you personally that you go, you know, I'm a better leader today because here's something I took away from that, maybe?
Yeah. You know, I think the big thing is that this company existing 10 years from now is more important than what's happening this month. Mm-hmm. And this company is bigger than all of us. I'm really, really much more clear on that than I ever was before. And so that doesn't mean, now I can be so much more heartless. Mm-hmm. But it does frame the way I talk to folks about what we're doing.
Yeah.
It causes me to ironically actually be a little more determined to grow this thing, to give us some more protection. You know, every year as we grow, we do have a little bit more protection. Our business is more diversified. You know, and it did make me realize that our diversification is a huge strength of ours.
Yeah.
We don't have any one customer that's just like, oh man, if we lost that customer, made me understand that. And honestly, it made me get really good at understanding when we need to raise prices and be really like, I'd rather lose the business than lose money on business.
Absolutely. I totally get this. That there are times when you have to fire the customer.
Right.
Right? You have to call them up and say, look, you and I are at a crossroads here.
Yep.
I can't lose money on this.
Right.
If you can't accept this, then we need to figure out a way to separate.
Yeah. Yep. And we've been really lucky that we've never gotten to that point with anybody. And I think it's because we have the hard conversations before we actually take that step.
So do you think that's part of your lessons learned to have the hard conversation sooner?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Be honest about who you are. Understand what compromising that for growth actually means. Because I would argue that you should just absolutely never compromise what you're trying to accomplish just to grow.
Right.
Not if you want to like your job.
Right.
Your job is just going to get incredibly stressful if you're making a lot of compromises for growth. That's my perspective.
Yeah, agreed. So for social entrepreneurs who are not as far down the road as you, what's one or maybe two pieces of advice, but a solid piece of advice of something that you've learned along the way that you'd like to pass along?
I think, you know, one of the biggest things that I've learned is that you would be amazed at who'd be willing to talk to you.
Mm.
If you have an interesting idea and a passion and you pick up the phone, I can't tell you how amazed I've been by the people who, if I've just called them and said, hey, here's who I am, here's what I'm trying to do, would you be willing to sit down with me, or would you be willing to give me some time and hear the growth challenges I'm trying to navigate right now? It's amazing. People are incredibly receptive, especially in this world of businesses that are trying to figure out a different paradigm. People will really be willing to give you way more time than you can imagine, and way more open and honest advice than I ever expected.
That's great. I love that. How can people find Peace Coffee on the web or on social media or online on social media?
Website's just peacecoffee.com. Twitter is peace_coffee, and find us on Facebook at Peace Coffee as well.
Yeah. Do you distribute globally? You distribute in the U.S. Can people buy online? How does that work?
Yes. PeaceCoffee.com is the first place to go and look. We have two different options. There's just a Find Us tab.
Mm-hmm.
So you can put in your zip code and find retailers near you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are mainly centered in the middle of the country, of the middle of the United States, but you can find us on the coasts as well.
Mm-hmm.
You can also order our product online there.
That's great. So people have been listening to us for a little while now, and so they can just hit next on their podcast player, or they can go do something else. If there was one thing that you would like to see people go and do as a result of having heard this conversation,
yeah,
what would that be?
You know, I would say go for it, pursue your dreams. I mean, my big piece, I'm getting to this point in life where I'm realizing that I made a really conscious decision 12 years ago where I decided, you know what, I need to figure out something that works for me. And as I said earlier, for a while that meant working for myself. Mm-hmm. But what I see now is a beginning of taking 2 years to really sort out how I'm going to grow into being able to be my real self at work, being able to be fulfilled at work, not worrying about work-life balance, because it's, you know, I am at this state of work-life integration. You know, I think, you know, just you can do it and continue to focus on how you're going to walk this path.
Good. All right. Lee, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tony.
And thanks to you, the listener, for joining us today. You are the reason that we produce Social Entrepreneur every Monday. Be sure to join us next Monday, where we'll be joined by Nakul Saran of Fish Forever. If you'd like the show notes for today, head over to tonyloyd.com/096. And while you're there, you're going to be able to find the link to register for our upcoming webinar, How to Make a Difference While Making a Living. Hint, no ramen noodles are required. Well, listen, thanks so much for joining us today. And until next time, please remember to use this one short, amazing life and go make an impact. Thanks. We'll talk to you next time on Social Entrepreneur.